Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You'll find the club online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and their YouTube channel. I'm Steve Ward, Senior Vice President, Small Business Segment Manager for the Pacific North Region, and your chair for this program. Tonight's program about fair trade and corporate responsibility is sponsored by Wells Fargo, and we're very excited that you're here for the discussion with our panel of experts. For over 160 years, Wells Fargo has been committed to helping the communities we live in thrive. We know providing financial solutions is only part of the equation. In the Bay Area alone, we have over 20,000 team members who have volunteered almost 100,000 hours giving back to the community, in addition to the over $20 million we gave to nonprofits and schools in the Bay Area last year. As an organization that prides itself in being actively engaged in the communities we live, we are proud to be partnering with the Commonwealth Club to bring forward tonight's program. Our panel represents a brain trust of expertise in the many global issues of fair trade. We are thrilled that they are here for a robust discussion of the real-world reasons why businesses are choosing to prioritize the social good along with their bottom line. Let me introduce our guests. From my left, Maya Spall, Director of New and Emerging Categories at Fairtrade USA, Edouard Rollet, co-founder of Alter Eco, Brooke McDonald, co-founder of Equator Coffee, Tierra Del Forte, Director of Product and Merchandising of Pact Apparel, and our moderator, Haven Bork, a public relations specialist who focuses on food, environment, and community, and serves as the principal of Haven B Media. Please join me in welcoming this impressive group. Haven, take it away.
Thank you, Steve. I'm Haven Bork, and I'm grateful to be your moderator for this program. This is a wonderful time to be an ethically inclined American consumer. I walk into any supermarket, as I did today in my hometown of Oakland, the new Sprouts Market just opened, and I saw, and you will see, a veritable wall of fair trade certified products. Today there are over 30 categories of certified fair trade, ranging from coffee to rice, from wine to apparel. And according to Fairtrade USA, the volume of these responsibly sourced products jumped almost fivefold in 2014. So it's going well, and thanks to everyone's great work. Yet, a billion people, the people who grow, who harvest, who bring us all this good stuff, still often sell the fruits of their labor for less than the cost of production. So despite all the successes, we've got a ways to go. And tonight we're really honored to have a panel of wonderful businesses who are working very hard to do the right thing on behalf of these farmers, on behalf of American consumers, and doing the right things as ethical businesses. So tonight we're going to hear a lot about the fair trade model, which is focused on social justice, sustainable development, environmental protection, and also helps support corporate social responsibility goals. We'll hear tonight how far we've come and also how far we have to go. There's a lot that connects everyone on this panel. Most of us have known each other for quite some time. And all of you folks have deep, long, and industry-varied history in making fair trade certification work for farmers, businesses, and consumers who want to make these ethical purchasing choices. And each of you also represents an industry first. Brooke McDonald of Equator Coffees was the first Fairtrade certified coffee licensee in the Bay Area around 1999. Yes. And just this month, not to rest on her laurels, the Equator team won a very prestigious Good Food Award with coffee that was produced on Brooke and Helen and Maureen's own farm called Finca Sofia in Panama. So not only is she a business leader, she is a farmer herself. Hers is the only coffee served at the very prestigious French Laundry restaurant. So we look forward to hearing a lot from Brooke. Edouard and his folks at Alter Eco was the first to go way beyond coffee. He brought us quinoa, which we'll be talking a lot about, as popular as kale, if not more so. And he also has brought us rice, sugar, and chocolate, and a variety of other products. And today, Alter Eco is working with over 5,300 farmers in 9 countries. That is so impressive. And tonight he brought us chocolate to taste, which really does make him a pretty terrific guest, if all that weren't enough. And Tierra pioneered fair trade and organic textile, which is a very interesting and I find quite complex supply chain. My entire household wears packed under garments. And I've worn her organic premium denim as well when I was slightly thinner. So we look forward to hearing her sort of demystify this entire supply chain. And finally, Maya, working with Fairtrade USA, is now focused on finding ever more new products for the Fairtrade certified model, including seafood. And she's also working on domestic fair trade certification, both of which I'm extremely eager to hear about. So, first, I would like each of you to touch briefly on three core points about fair trade. What is fair trade certification really? Why does it matter so much today in today's socioeconomic and environmental landscape? And how is the fair trade certified label still relevant in this era of certification proliferation? And I brought just a few boxes of tea, and they're definitely crowded with many labels, and they all mean different things, or maybe some of them mean the same thing. So Maya, we look forward to hearing you demystify some of this for us. Maya, please kick this off for us. Give us a brief description of what fair trade is and how it matters so much today.
So, fair trade certified products. When you purchase a fair trade certified product, it's your guarantee that it was traded in a more ethical way. That boils down to safer working conditions, improved livelihoods, and environmental protection. Right now, we know that there's people around the world living on less than $2 a day. And as consumers, we have a choice to vote with our dollars. And when you buy a product that's fair trade certified, more money goes directly back into the pockets of the hardworking farmers and workers in factories and fishermen that create these products.
Good. Okay. Talk to us a little bit about the relevance of the label in the world of label overload.
Sure. Well, you know, behind that label is a very robust audit. So that means that we go, we work with auditors that go to these farms and go to these factories and apply a 300-point check to ensure that all of the standards are being adhered to. And I think we're in a time when consumers, let's say, have a little bit of mistrust for large corporations, if I may say that. So I think that when you have a third party checking and you have an ability to buy a product that is certified, then you can have more confidence in what's behind that promise and that guarantee. In terms of label proliferation, I think all of us have to decide what's important to us when we're buying products. And you know, the fair trade certified label, we're really excited. About 58% of consumers know that label, recognize that label, and, you know, are actively choosing to purchase those products. So, you know, it's been a good experience for us to help consumers understand that behind a label is a promise. Organic certified as well, and on and on.
Interesting. Good. Edouard.
So my name is Edouard Rollet. I'm the co-founder and co-CEO of Alter Eco. We are a San Francisco-based fair trade organic food brand. We are a leading brand of fair trade organic royal quinoa from Bolivia. Dark chocolate with cacao we source from Peru and Ecuador, as well as jasmine rice from Thailand and unrefined sugar from the Philippines. So we sell our products to about 4,000 or 5,000 grocery stores throughout the United States, in Canada, New Zealand, and Australia. What really would define and differentiate us is that we, since we started, we really went to find unique crop, what we call in French, where I'm from, in case you haven't noticed, terroir. So the idea of terroir is really that, you know, farmers have been cultivating their land for a long time, and soil and climate really create the condition to have the really best product. And so we go to those farmers, all of them earning a dollar a day or two, all of them living in the global south, Thailand, India, Bolivia, Ecuador, Peru, etc. But they all have great products, but they get paid less than what it costs them to grow the product. So we go to those farmers, trade directly with them, and then sell to grocery store and kind of shift the value the way the revenue is spread so that the farmers and their community can get more money for their crops. So that's really what we are doing. When we started about 15 years ago, fair trade coffee was just starting. It wasn't too much in the States. It was in European supermarkets. And from our travel, all four co-founders of Alter Eco were working for NGOs in development. I was working for UNICEF. My other co-founders were working for orphanages, etc. And so we had traveled a lot, and we saw all those farmers, and we saw that the issue that you have with commodities, right, with a $7-$8 product you pay in supermarkets, the farmers were not getting enough money for it. It was true for coffee, but it was true for tea and fruits and sugar and rice and etc. But we have a whole range of products that we sell, because we know that by trading directly with those farmers, we can in some significant ways address their global poverty problem. So that's how the company started. Our goal, our mission, is to maximize impact by growing volume, meaning that when you start buying 40, 50 containers of a product from communities a year, you really start to see life-changing progress. And that's why I'm here today to talk about. And I think, so quinoa is one of our flagship main products. We started selling quinoa in 2004. Nobody could even pronounce the name, and it was fun. And that's a really, for me, that's an important product as far as demonstrating the power of market-based, the way we can really think about fair trade, which is consumer demand that really is able to grow impact at origin. So quinoa is originally grown in Bolivia by indigenous farmer. Bolivia is a poorest country of South America, and Maya and Aymaran indigenous farmers in Bolivia are the poorest people of Bolivia. So here you have the poorest of the poorest in Latin America growing a product that you would buy $6-$7 at your local supermarket.
Right, Edward, let me stop you here, because I'm going to dig in later rather deeply. We want to hear a lot more about quinoa.
I'll just conclude to say that what we are doing is really about, making sure that the product you buy in supermarket really goes back to the farmers.
Yeah. Good.
Thank you.
Great support.
Keeping me on time.
52. Yeah. So, Brooke, let's hear a little bit from you about what you think, what does fair trade certification really mean to you now?
My name is Brooke McDonald. I co-founded Equator with my partner Helen Russell and Maureen McHugh about 20 years ago. And I've been very fortunate to see the different generations of coffee, and we keep creating new frontiers. So I've seen a lot of exciting impact movements in coffee, and fair trade really came to my awareness when 15 years ago, the specialty coffee market dropped to 40 cents a pound for farmers, and a lot of them were abandoning their crops. And there was real fear of there being a silent spring for coffee, and I think it was a legitimate fear. And so I think fair trade played a critical role in providing an economic, a socioeconomic safety net. And I think at a time when it said we have to make sure there's a minimum floor price paid for specialty coffee that exceeds the cost of production. And when Paul Rice, I was fortunate to sit in on a presentation in 1999, and it really, he was very compelling, won over my heart and mind. It made sense. I feel that fair trade doesn't get enough credit for setting the stage for a lot of movements in coffee and consciousness raising. I think I'm very fortunate to be in an industry that's very progressive. I think a lot of what you're reading about third wave direct trade is influenced a lot by fair trade. I think it raised a lot of consciousness and awareness of the producer viability issues with coffee.
Great. Tiara. What does it mean to you, and what is its relevance in today's socioeconomic and environmental landscape? Yeah. Particularly important for textiles, yeah.
Yeah, very important for textiles. And one way I think apparel is different from food and coffee is that there isn't logo proliferation in our industry. There's nothing out there to inform consumers about the products they're buying. And PACT, which was actually founded by two Haas MBA students, the whole idea around the company was to make basics, at that time underwear, because change starts with your underwear, that people would know where and how it was made, and people who were looking for organic and fair trade coffee and other food products would not the first time ever, but there wasn't a lot of options out there for people who wanted to buy that, and so that's why PACT is.
Well, we're glad it is. Now we have something to wear. Something that's intimate should also be probably the first thing that you take care with. So my household is glad it's out there for sure.
PACT is the Hanes of the change generation, is what they like to say. We love that.
That's right. Good.
Okay, so I'd like to pass the ball briefly to Maya and hear a little bit about the certification process. Why are there different certifiers right now? There's domestic, there's international. Kind of what's going on out there in terms of what American consumers need to know and how they can make an ethical choice when they're faced with these kind of extensive menus for certification?
Yeah, so I mean, behind our label is a very robust audit, as I mentioned, and so I think that I need more from you on that question.
Sure.
I feel like I answered it a little bit before.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to look at the tea boxes here, and I think you did say that consumers can make their own choices.
Sure.
But I've got to say, even though I have worked in this field for a long time, I look at the box and I see 100% fair trade. I see USDA organic. I see non-GMO verified, certified gluten-free. And then when I flip this one to the side, I see wind power. And it's a small box.
Yeah.
So
the good news is that companies care and they are involved in making changes across all different aspects of their supply chain. So whether it's wind powered or ensuring that it's gluten-free, which is, or food safety or organic, it's great that companies are committing to that and they want credit. So that's why those labels are on there. I mean, that's what I would say. And I think, as I mentioned before, as an educated consumer, it's all about understanding what you need out of a product and what you want to cast your vote on with your dollars. So obviously, if you're gluten-free, that's a win for you. But it's just about, I think, companies wanting to share what's in the product.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Interesting. Well, I mean, that seems like a good basic. And now let's get into the really hard stuff. As we said in the opening, it's pretty fascinating to know that there is up-and-coming fair trade certification of fish and seafood. The Associated Press and the New York Times in 2015 did fairly extensive series of articles on slavery in the seafood industry. Yeah. And I think there was quite a bit of focus on shrimp fishing boats in Thailand where impoverished workers were literally held captive, or workers in factories where shrimp was being peeled were simply trapped and essentially working as slaves. So what can fair trade do to help with this terrible situation?
Yeah, so as you mentioned at the beginning, Fairtrade USA certifies over 30 product categories. And I'm really fortunate in that the work that I do is we go out and look at what new areas would be appropriate for fair trade certification. And we do that by looking at where the need is and then also partnering with companies that really want to make a difference. And so, seafood is really interesting. For those of you that know about ocean conservation, that movement really began with a lens on how do we save the oceans? How do we save the fish? But what we know is that human behavior, and if you're a fisherman who's not earning enough money, you're going to just overfish because you need to support your family. And so we began to look at the sector. We had some fishermen come to us. We had some companies come to us. And we were really astounded to find that there was no social certification and there were really no monitoring programs around working conditions in the seafood sector at all. So we really felt compelled to enter into the space. And, you know, it's been a really amazing journey for us. We now have certified yellowfin tuna in Indonesia, and you can go to your local Safeway store and buy in the frozen section fair trade certified tuna steaks. It's delicious. I highly recommend it. We've certified shrimp in Mexico, and we have a lot more fisheries in the pipeline. And these fishermen are seeing really incredible benefit. Not only is it looking at making sure that they're safe on the boats and teaching a lot of safety at sea, but again, they're getting more money and they're able to invest back into their communities. It also means that the products are processed in a better way. You know, it's cleaner. It's really a win for everyone. And then, of course, you guys can go buy that product in the store.
Good. We feel optimistic about that. I look forward to trying some of that seafood.
And there's a lot to come with that category, so keep an eye on it.
Terrific. Brooke, let's go to you now. I mean, coffee being one of the foundational product of the fair trade movement. You referenced third wave coffee a bit, and it seems to me that this whole idea of third wave has brought so many wonderful innovations to coffee. I mean, care with sourcing, focus on quality, attention to brewing, it's a whole new world out there, and that a lot of small scale local micro roasters are thriving. Mm-hmm. But when I walk into even some of my favorite stalwart Oakland cafes, I don't feel like they're paying a lot of attention to fair trade. Why do you think that's so? Do you agree with me? And if you do, why do you think that's so?
I feel free
to disagree. Yeah.
I agree. And I think that the third wave, the sensibility and the approach to coffee and changing the transaction and raising it into a sort of a wine-like terroir category of appreciation has been fantastic for the industry. I think that I think the problem that I see is that I miss a little bit when I came on board the attention to social justice issues, socioeconomic issues. I think that the good news about the third wave is they do pay. I think the focus is really on single region coffees and not so much cooperative coffees. So I'm not so sure that the small roasters who we try to source a lot from the boutique sector, which is basically the top of the mountain, that's not a lot of the world production. And there's a vast territory of specialty grade coffee out there that is sort of a middle of the mountain and quite good, but I think there is a interest more now in the boutique, which is there's impact, but it's on a much more micro audience and a much more sort of micro producers. So I think there's a lot of exciting things going on with coffee. I think it's it's in its infancy. We're in the discovery phase. I think that with fair trade, that the issue is with the third wave is they feel like they've moved beyond fair trade, which is that they're buying direct trade. They meet the producer, they have direct trade relationships, they're paying high prices. And that is true, but I think that what is missing is the attention to the cooperatives that can produce very good coffee. But there are also fair trade certified cooperatives. But there's not a lot of attention given to that segment. And I think there's a romance now happening with the top of the mountain, is really what I call it. And it's fantastic coffee. We're involved in it. It's exciting. It's nature and nurture at the top of the mountain, slow growth, thinner air. So the quality of the coffee fruit can be fantastic. But I think that for roasters that are wholesale roasters like ourselves, we have a big audience. We have a boutique segment, and we love sourcing, and we've won numerous awards. But we also want to buy from cooperatives that have perfectly good specialty coffee, and it's consistent. They have good production values. So we buy about a third of what we buy is certified fair trade, and it's very good. However, I think we're unique because most of the focus right now in this new generation is very highly specific. And I don't think that it's scalable in terms of impact. So I think with fair trade, the important thing is that coffee purveyors that buy for different audiences and have a big wholesale market, that's where you're going to see the impact. I think the third wave, or I should say it's a little overused, this latest generation of coffee purveyors, I'm not so much sure. I think they're going to have an impact on coffee appreciation, and I think this generation is really important for raising consciousness around terroir and how hard it is to grow coffee, and then the rise of the producer star. That's exciting, but in terms of scalable impact and in terms of fair trade, I think that we're going to have to look at bigger companies that buy a lot of coffee and also have a larger audience that might like French roast, or that they want to, you know, they want to buy some good specialty grade, but they don't want to, you know, pay $10 a pound to sell French roast. So sure.
That makes sense. And you may have answered this question already, but it may be something along the same theme. But the New Yorker magazine in the last few years did a very deep and quite loving profile of Aida Batley, who's a fifth generation woman coffee farmer from El Salvador. And she recently visited Ecuador's new retail location, is that correct? And did a cupping or a tasting with you, which I was thrilled to see that. And I'm a great fan of her work. And I loved the profile, but I was very concerned that in an article of many thousands of words, fair trade got only half a sentence mentioned, and it was lumped in with Rainforest Alliance as, quote, a patchwork of certifications assuring coffee farmers higher prices in exchange for specific economic and environmental practices.
It did get short shift in that.
Why so tiny? Is it the same?
Now, Aida is a rock star, and this is one of the byproducts of this new, and she really thought outside the box when she went back to El Salvador and took over her family farm, so I have a lot of respect for her, and she decided to try to communicate with a new audience that she knew was emerging. So she represents, I think we have two audiences that are happening. That one that says quality leads to sustainability, and the other that says it has to be socioeconomic conditions lead to sustainability. I think they're both right. But I don't think they're mutually exclusive. But she really, she understood that that was another way for the grower to maybe get a premium, was to focus on designing this gorgeous coffee. She had her family farms, had the set of conditions. And so she really has been a big part of this rise of the producer star who takes decisions. It's so hard to craft good coffee. And it's not a prolific producer. Again, it's not scalable. But it is, she's certainly made ripples. But I think she represents the reason why you're not seeing fair trade, and this is exactly what I'm saying. I think that the focus of the writer, I think it was Kefasela?
Yes, I think so, yeah.
Great journalist. He did a good, but the consciousness for fair trade, it's seen as more other companies' issues, or it's for last century companies, or it's for wholesale large companies. The thing is, a lot of our colleagues don't have a wholesale business like we do. They just don't. So they don't buy many different types of coffee. Their focus is narrow. And so you won't find fair trade in their lexicon. I think you will always find it in our lexicon, but I'm not saying it in a righteous way. but it represents about, again, a third of what we buy. I also feel like it's a big tent. Coffee is a huge tent. I mean, there's many types of, there's, and just as a point about fair trade, I'm jumping around a little bit, but it is not, one size does not fit all. Fair trade does not fit in every single environment and market. It certainly provides economic safety net. And I think it's critical for co-ops to feel like they can opt in and find security. But there's many, many areas like Ecuador that feel like they can find a market without being certified. One of our long-term suppliers feels that they don't want to have the burden of certification and paying it. So it's not, I'm bound to sort of make both groups unhappy here, because I think that there's lots of good. I don't want to make the pursuit of perfection the enemy of good. And I think fair trade is very good. But I do feel like it's had more success in some areas than others. And I think it's important for consumers to be aware it's a good label. It's a good movement, but it's not, there's no perfect model. Again, one size doesn't fit all. And I think that for Ada's market, I think the premiums being paid for that coffee are so beyond fair trade premiums, but they're the top of the top. So I don't know if fair trade is really relevant. I guess I'm saying it's not relevant to that niche, but I think it is very relevant to large purchasers of containers of coffee in large quantities. Mm-hmm.
The philosopher poet of coffee, no, Brooke McDonald. You have your hers, yes, yes.
The long-winded. Don't get me started.
Coffee is a big tent, but consumer purchases still really matter. Yes, all right. And now I am to remind the radio audience that this is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we are talking to Maya Spall, Director of New and Emerging Categories at Fairtrade USA, Edouard Rollet, co-founder of Alter Eco, Brooke McDonald, co-founder of Equator Coffee, and Tara Forte, Del Forte, Director of Product and Merchandising at Pact Apparel, and I am Haven Bork, your moderator. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio, catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter, and see program videos on your YouTube channel. Next, it's time to really talk about quinoa. And Edouard, again, it's impressive that your company was one of the first to sell such a breadth of products. And you were also one of the first to reach a foodie consumer, which I think really has moved the model forward. And you touched a little bit on commodities and the difference between a commodity and a specialty product. Could you define for the audience, what, now that we're under the big tent, what is a commodity product anyway in terms of the food world, in terms that a general consumer could understand?
What is a first, I want just to rebound on the discussion before, because I think it's interesting that we're all here to talk about the sustainability effort, commitments, and what we do as companies. But what we are known for is actually not that, and that's what we want. We are known for the quality of the products we sell. I mean, if you go to Equator Coffee, people just go because they love their cup of Equator Coffee, and they're not going to go across the street. They're going to go to Equator because they just love it. And that's how you bring people to your store, your product. Or, you know, Pact is the same, you know, wearing Pact right now because I just like the feel of it. I'm not going to go too deep into that, but not going to show it, but you know, and I hope, and I think it's the same with Alter Eco. People just love their Alter Eco chocolate and the creaminess and the taste profile. And so I think that's really important to keep that in mind, is that, you know, we infuse mission, and as companies, we really work on that. But the number one thing that we're really proud of, and why people consumers come back to our products, is really the quality of the product. Talking, that's a good segue into the commodity business, because I mean, and we see it, you know, being inside of the chain, but there is a very big pressure of price. You know, consumers, they want what you see on TV, what you see on commercial. You need more for less, more for less, more for less. Well, and that's really the dynamic. And you know, I think this era will be over soon. But this is really what we're, you know, our culture right now. And so this pressure that comes from consumers and go back to the chain. At some point when you say, I need more for less, who's the last person in the chain? Well, it's a farmer. Mm-hmm. And so that explains why, even though prices in grocery stores have been going on up in the last 30 years, the price at origin has been going down. Right? Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the problems with commodities, is just the dynamic, I think, of the consumption of new countries having the same needs as what we have, like with Asia and all that. And so that creates a lot of pressure on natural resources.
Yeah. So are you touching here on the you're inferring?
On the dynamic on fair trade and why fair trade started.
Right. Well, yes. And the problem with the quinoa boom, because I think a lot of us are kind of worried about quinoa. There has been a series of articles saying that actually, spurred, I'm sure, by companies who intend to do absolutely the right thing and consumers who want to eat something healthy and eat this beautiful, delicious, high-protein vegan product, the demand has gotten so high that it's, in fact, impossible for the farmers who grow it to consume this important, culturally traditional, important food. So address that a little bit. Like what do you do when you become a victim of your own success in terms of helping farmers?
It's interesting. Yeah. And it's been, it's funny, those articles, they come out once and then they get recycled every so often. And but that raises a good question. And 4 or 5 years ago, Time magazine published a story about, it's true, quinoa price went up because demand went up. And they were saying that people couldn't eat quinoa anymore in Bolivia because the price was higher than the price of chicken. So in case you didn't know, now we know. But that's a really good question. And I've been interviewed a few times in the press about that. It's a bit frustrating, and I've been going to Bolivia because, again, that's a big part of our business, and I've been going, every year, twice a year for the last at least 12 years, and this is a bit frustrating. It is true that, the fact and the matter is that Bolivia, and especially indigenous farmers, were the one cultivating quinoa. And it was considered the food of the poor and indigenous farmers, and so people in the cities never ate quinoa in the first place. And so, what I've seen, and it's again my own experience with Bolivia, is that the consumption pattern hasn't changed, meaning that in the cities they weren't eating quinoa. And they're not eating quinoa now. The price has increased. It raises questions. I'm not going to say there's no problem when you have a big boom suddenly on a very fragile environment. So, of course, environmental pressure. How do you make sure that farmers still care about their land while there's so much money to make on a crop? That's the only crop that grows. So quinoa grows 14,000 feet above sea level. In between volcanoes and salt flats, and the salt flats are just salt for 130 miles diameter. So it's really spectacular. And the only thing that you have there is llama and quinoa. There's nothing else. Nada, right? There's no bananas. There's nothing. It's a high desert. So nothing to grow. So of course you bring demand there, you kind of, and very strong cultures to Aymaran and Mayan, they have a very strong independent culture. So you kind of interrupt that with our demand, you do create some imbalance. But at the end of the day, the truth is really that not only the farmers are still eating quinoa, which is the main crop the main source of revenue for them, but what is a bit upsetting with this story about the people not being able to eat quinoa is that the real story behind that is that the changes that quinoa has brought to those communities is just amazing. We used to eat only quinoa and llama when we were growing vegan people, sorry, but we, llama. Quinoa and llama, and now they have enough money to go to the markets and buy tomatoes and salad and diversify their diet. Nobody talks about that. They used to have no bathroom. I remember going there. There's not a single public or private bathroom in the villages. You know, to get to a village, you have to drive 15, 18 hours on dirt road from La Paz. It's a really long drive. There's nothing, no bathroom. Well, in the last 10 years now, you see bathroom popping up everywhere. There's still 1 billion people on the planet that have no access to any type of, you know, bathroom. This is a lot of people, you know, 2.4 billion people who have no access to minimum, like, you know, this kind of, you know, facilities. So this is a huge problem. Now it's everywhere. Schools, scolarity, a lot of people are enrolled in schools because now they can have, not only in the rural, like very desolated environment, they can go to a bigger city where they can go to high school. So this is a real story behind quinoa, and this is a really strong story because you can really see the power of demand having an impact on those communities. So it's a really good example.
Good. I feel comforted by that, and I think we can all buy quinoa and continue to help farmers.
Not any quinoa. That's meaningful. What does fair trade do for quinoa? You know, I think it's the really important point. There are problems when you have money around, you have speculations, middlemen like you have in coffee with the coyotes. So with fair trade quinoa, you make sure that, number one, the money goes directly from the quinoa to the farmers. Really important, doesn't go to speculators who sometimes hold on the quinoa to get the price up and then release the quinoa. Very classic. It goes on to system just like us, making sure that there's a certain amount of the crop that is used for the household consumption, at least 10%. So there's no problem of farmers not eating their own quinoa, and making sure that a fair share of the final products, you know, money you pay, actually goes back to the farmers and their communities. So I think that's a really important point, and that shows the relevance of the fair trade label.
Excellent points. Well, we've saved one of the most complex issues for last, and I really want to hear from Tara about this. And I'm struggling because I have questions here, and we also have had some extremely impressive, detailed, and I would say hard-hitting questions from our audience, and we'd like a few minutes to address those too. But first, maybe you could come up with your own, what question would you like to ask yourself? I'd like to understand more about fair trade apparel and how it's different from food.
Yeah, so fair trade apparel, at least the way PACT is doing it, is we actually hit fair trade at two ends of the supply chain. So at the very beginning at the cotton farms where we buy fair trade cotton, and I think those issues are really similar to the issues that we've heard about in quinoa and coffee. And I think where fair trade apparel gets really interesting and different is at the factory level. And, you know, the idea is to bring the fair trade benefits that we associate with coffee and other products like that of additional income to people who desperately need it, actually empowerment for the people who are making these products, and then, of course, safety, which is a really important thing, as we all are aware of from the, you know, Bangladesh factory disaster. But how do you apply those things to a setting where you're not talking about people who own the land they're working on and own the product that they're selling? These are people who are going to work in a factory. How do you build community infrastructure when you've got people coming from, you know, hundreds of kilometers away to work in this factory? So, building a school in, you know, that town where the factory is, that's not actually going to help many of the workers and their families who are working there. So I think where fair trade has sort of elegantly solved this problem is by trying to bridge the gap between workers' wages that they're earning in the factory and what would be considered a living wage in that area. And they have a very robust methodology for doing this, where they assess the, what it costs to live locally, and then, you know, how far or close is that to what the workers are paid. And then basically the brand fills in that gap by paying a premium on top of what we pay to buy our product. And that premium goes into a fund that's pooled together, and then workers who are democratically elected by all the workers in the family decide how to spend those funds. And it can be as simple as, we're going to take this pool of money and we're going to distribute it as a cash bonus to all the workers in the factory. And, you know, I know people love to see a picture of a school or a picture of a new well, but really, when you're talking about people who are, you know, living in poverty, I think one of the most powerful things you can do is put more money in their pockets. And I think that trusting people to make the right decision with the money that you give them, I think that's the right thing to do, and that's how I would want to be treated. Which is not to say that fair trade isn't doing other things in factories as well. You know, I know that workers have purchased bicycles so that they can get save money and get to work quicker. But the thing that doesn't change is that it's workers deciding how to spend that money. It's not a brand going in there and saying, hey, this will look great in our annual report if you did this. And it's not even Fairtrade USA saying, you know, we've seen other communities do this, so why don't you do that? It really is about empowering workers in the factory to make their lives better themselves. That's a really hard story to tell to a consumer who picks up a product and looks at a hang tag maybe this big or a box this big. And at PACT, we do struggle with telling that story, but we try to do it, and we hope people who are interested in our brand are interested in learning about, you know, how and where our products are made, because on most clothes, all you get is a country of origin. And that doesn't tell you anything at all.
Mm-hmm. Can I add something to that?
Please.
So in our factory program, we work with both apparel and home goods. And, you know, PACT is one of our leading brands. We're also working with Patagonia, who this year will have about 250 unique products that are made in fair trade facilities. And then Williams-Sonoma, you know, a company based here, has made an incredible commitment that 40% of their products will be fair trade certified by 2020. And so what we are seeing is that companies like PACT and these other folks are coming together and telling the story of the factory worker. No longer sort of a nameless, faceless sewer behind a machine, but in fact a person with a family who, if you buy this piece of clothing and put on those underwear, or buy that, you know, blanket from, you know, West Elm, you're actually transforming lives.
Mm-hmm. Maya, you've probably seen a lot of fair trade producers and done a lot of visiting to Origin, to use coffee terminology. We're almost out of time, but I want to hear one story. I want to hear about a family or a person that you met. And Maya, you don't have to answer this, but if anyone, maybe one of you can, tell us one of those stories.
Oh my gosh, there's
briefly,
so many.
Because we only have a few minutes left.
And
we have
well, these so the thing is, like, I'm old girl fair trade. I've been working there for 11 years, and I've worked on every product except coffee, which is our biggest product. So I've always been really excited about doing the new stuff. I know. I think, you know, I would say that I had a really amazing experience once hunting for fair trade vanilla farmers in Indonesia. And we, you know, this is very typical in farms. You sort of drive as far as you can go, and then usually you walk, but they're like, okay, get out. And I got out, and there's just this like delegation of farmers on motorcycles, and they like point to me and point to the back of the bike, and I get on, and then we start going up and up and up and up into these hills, and it must have been, you know, miles, and we finally get out, and there's this sweet village, and these farmers who just took me and showed me how one by one they were hand pollinating vanilla plants to help them produce. And it struck me the amount of heart and time and labor that goes into cultivating these products and how far they are. I mean, if there was an emergency there, people would have to be carried down on a makeshift stretcher, 25 minutes. And so I think it was really impactful for me. That was probably midway into my career with Fairtrade to continue to work with this model that I think truly is transformational and to reach the folks that aren't being reached by traditional trade.
That's a phenomenal story. All to flavor our cupcakes.
It was fun.
Yeah.
It's great. Fairtrade vanilla.
Yes.
Fairtrade vanilla.
Yes. Go. Question to the Commonwealth Club organizers. Are we allowed to go over by a few minutes? We have some wonderful questions here, and I don't want to miss the opportunity to ask at least one of them, which I think is probably all the time that we have. I will take editorial license, and I will combine two of these really good questions. And I'm going to end on somewhat of a sober note, because in truth, there are many problems that still need to be solved, and that's why people need to buy products. Put your money where your mouth is and buy products that really do have social impact. So the question is, with fair trade marketing and labels being in the market very extensively, we still have not solved any large global issues. What is it that still needs to be done in order to tackle this structurally complex problem? And what could have been done better? And because I assume you all consider yourselves social entrepreneurs, how would that reflect upon your approach to solving these deep global problems?
I mean, all right. I mean, fair trade is still 0.001% of international trade. So we do have a long way to go. I think it's important to think that, you know, what's behind this whole movement as well is that fair trade, I mean, we had organic before because of all the pesticides, etc. But fair trade is really what, you know, brought people to think where their food comes from. Well, who grew that? Where does it come from? You know, what is the whole journey of this food that I'm eating now? And so now you're getting to a paradigm shift. You know, we see it. I mean, fair trade market, we talk about the new sprouts, and, you know, it's growing. It's growing at a pace. What I find very encouraging is that the food, you know, the food space, the food segment is growing 2% a year. And the organic food segment, most of which is fair trade, is growing 25% a year for the last 10 years, and it's not slowing down. So what does that mean? It means that the 0.01% is growing pretty fast, and is growing much faster than kind of the old school food. So I think between the paradigm shift that you see in people's mind and in the media and the actual growth of the segment, I'm pretty confident that the whole thing is going to shift. And fair trade, and you can talk about that, Maya, but yeah, fair trade, what really triggered this whole thing is that how come those people are growing great products and they're so poor, they're poorer every day, well, they work harder every day, and they end up in the slums in Bangkok or Rio or Sao Paulo or whatever. So how come that happened? And then little by little we realize, well, look, those farmers live in deforested area where we may be able to solve some of the climate change problem and really regenerate the ecosystem and the forest. And then that and that and that. And then we end up tackling modestly. You know, we're small in the grand scheme of things, but, you know, I think we're also, you know, showing the way to some larger company, which are really welcome to join us, by the way. And they understand this is important for them. And then little by little, actually, we have a bigger impact than what we think. And that's what I like to think as well.
Mm-hmm. Good. Yeah, I mean, we're trying to solve a huge issue. I mean, let's just go solve global poverty. I mean, this is massive. And so we believe that fair trade is a tool in the toolbox. And we're so proud to be amongst other wonderful organizations that are doing transformational work, whether it's through actual products and through product certification, or it's Kiva, who does microloans, and on and on. And so I think that, you know, we are... Our goal someday is to put ourselves out of a job. I mean, yeah, that would be ideal, as if every trade is just and equitable. It's just not our reality, and I don't know if it'll happen in our lifetime, but we're going to work hard to be a part of the solution.
I think it's structural, too. I heard that word, and it stuck in my mind, because basically I think we have to do nothing short of changing capitalism into a stakeholder value type event. I'm not anti-capitalism, but I think the shareholder value, I don't know if it leads to a healthier society, and I think there has to be a cultural shift within for-profit companies. I think there has to be, and I think it's happening. I think as the B Corp movement, and I think it's happening with small business first and then mid-size, but I think I'm optimistic that we're going to see some structural shift with this next generation of businesses. But, yeah.
I would say in apparel, we're sort of still looking for the proof of concept and that showing that this can be done and you can make products that are affordable and have the quality that people expect. Fair trade products, at least in apparel, are never going to be the cheapest thing you can buy. But I know at Pact, our prices are very reasonable. And what we expect our customer to pay a little bit more than they would if they were buying something at Walmart or Kmart. But in exchange for that, we deliver them a really good product. So the value is there. And, you know, again, I think we're just at this point kind of trying to prove that this works.
Yeah, good. Well, let's keep soldiering on. And actually, we were going to touch on this question about prospects for domestic fair trade and in the U.S., which I think would probably have significant relevance to the textile and apparel industry. I know when I shop at these cool, funky little locally owned boutiques in Oakland, where I try to shop, I'm an absolute hound for labels that say made in USA. And I'm seeing more and more of them all the time, even on garments that aren't that expensive. So give us a little brief. We have do have a little bit of time left. And there were a few questions about what's going on. What are the prospects for fair trade working with US-based companies, products, and certifying workers and making things better for US workers?
Yeah. So basically, since day one, when we started certifying coffee, we started getting messages from American farmers, apple growers in Washington State, orange growers in Florida, saying, well, we see that you're doing this fair trade model. What about us? And what about the workers that are on our farms? And, you know, I think at the moment, well, at the moment, for the first 17 years of our inception, you know, we've worked really hard overseas with producers in, you know, over 72 countries. But we have been very much engaged in the dialogue and watching what's happening on U.S. farms in terms of migrant labor, undocumented workers, people who are in very dire situation. And so we feel really compelled to become a part of that. And along with some really enlightened retailers, we're looking at moving on to U.S. agricultural farms for fruits and vegetables. From the apparel side, we actually certified our first factory in Los Angeles this year. Okay. And so there is a t-shirt factory called Nature USA. They're based in L.A. They are producing fair trade certified products. The workers in that factory are mostly of Mexican and Guatemalan heritage. They are now receiving fair trade premiums. They just had a payout of cash of the cash bonus at the holiday time, and many of them talked about how they have children who are getting to school age and they're saving for their education, and it's been a really sweet project, and we're really excited about what's to come and very hopeful that, you know, in the upcoming years you're going to be able to go into your local grocery store and buy a fair trade pineapple from Costa Rica and buy a fair trade apple from Washington State.
That gives us a lot to look forward to, certainly. Yeah. Yeah. We have just a few minutes left, so I think I'll ask one more question, and I would like to hear a variety of answers from different panelists. We are watching the local food movement go absolutely gangbusters. There's no other word for it. I see particularly young American consumers shopping extensively at farmers markets, paying attention to which area in California their tomatoes are grown and whether they're dry farmed or not. And the level of passion and interest in the local sustainable food movement, I must say, from where I sit, having worked in this industry for almost 20 years, is unprecedented. It gives me great hope for where fair trade is going in the future. So if you could envision a perfect future for fair trade, one that would parallel a local food movement in which young people who do not necessarily have the deepest pockets in the world are absolutely willing to pay $5 a pound for a dry, farmed, organic tomato from Watsonville, and they want to stand there at the farmer's market and talk to the woman who grew it, What does that bode for the future of fair trade and food and other goods that are ethically sourced?
I mean, I like Maya's comment that the ultimate goal of fair trade is to put itself out of business. I mean, we want to live in a world where the idea that you made something that hurt somebody is just unfathomable, and that those are not viable products in the market.
We've always talked about fair trade products as being coming, you know, as coming from your global farmers market, right? And so even if you can't meet your farmer like you can at your, you know, local market, you can hear their story, you can see imagery of them, you can understand their situation and help them by purchasing those products. So I think that's one thing that we really try to do is make that connection for the consumer.
Yeah, I think the current specialty coffee scene very much parallels the slow food movement. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of the timeliness of it.
Yeah, I think coffee is a particularly good example mm-hmm. of that. We're micro roasters. Mm-hmm. If you live in Oakland, you will shun a coffee roasted in San Francisco mm-hmm. just for the pride of your city.
Yeah. And I just want to mention that a fair trade Ethiopian Wadadera that we submitted to the Good Food Awards, and I think it was 2012, it won the top coffee, fair trade certified. Mm-hmm.
I think the goal as well is that, I mean, it's great. Whole Foods has plenty of fair trade organic, but, and, you know, don't quote me on that. We love those partners. They've really been, you know, the pioneers and the leaders, but we don't want to be elitist, and we want, you know, Mr. Joan in, you know, Bento, Arkansas, whatever, you know, we want everybody to be to have access to that, and so that's why sometimes people say, "Oh, Adrico, why do you work with a supermarket chain?" And there's no reason why people who don't have a Whole Foods, you know, in their vicinity can't have access to organic fair trade products. So I hope that as the movement grows, as we become bigger and more efficient. It's because we're small as well that we're a bit more expensive, that then we can have a larger reach and really be affordable and available to anybody who wants to support that and have access to that.
Mm, good. All right. Well, I think in closing, I would like to thank all of our amazing panelists, thanking Maya Spall, Director of New and Emerging Categories at Fairtrade USA, Edouard Roulet, co-founder of Alter Eco, Brooke McDonald, co-founder of Equator Coffee, Tierra Del Forte, director of product and merchandising at Pact Apparel. We would also like to thank Wells Fargo Bank for underwriting this program. I'm Haven Bork, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.